From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 159, where I'm joined by extraordinary woman Melina Roberts. Dr. Melina Roberts is a naturopathic doctor, author of Building a Healthy Child, and founder of Advanced Naturopathic Medical Center in Calgary. She is recognized as one of the top biological medicine practitioners in North America and is a leading authority in the field of naturopathic medicine, specializing in biological medicine, effectively treating digestive issues, chronic disease, and cancer. Dr. Roberts is a graduate of the University of Waterloo and the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine in Toronto, and did a 2-year postgraduate study in biological medicine with Parcellus Clinic in Switzerland. She has been selected to be TEDx speaker for 2021. It was interesting. After recording with Melina, I became much more aware of how my body reacts to different meals. I realized, and have noticed this before, that meals very heavy in fat, especially when protein-rich too, tend to make me feel a bit sick. So I'm thinking through some options regarding gallbladder support supplements or simply changing the macro content of those meals to better suit me. As you all hear, she has some interesting things to say about the gallbladder, bile production, and thyroid function, and a few things really clicked into place for me. I hope you find this episode as interesting and useful as I did. Welcome, Melina, to the Keto Woman podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me, Daisy. I'm excited to be here.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. I was very pleased to get your email. You sound like a very interesting guest. So I'm just going to hand over to you and ask you to tell me and the people at home a bit about you and your story.
Well, my story starts back in my childhood as being a kid who had really bad allergies and eczema and, you know, would itch my skin until it would bleed, you know, those just suffering through that. And when I was about 13, a family friend said to my parents, you know, you should try taking her to see a naturopathic doctor. And they brought me to see a naturopathic doctor, and within a pretty short period of time, all of my allergies and eczema cleared up. So wow. It just was my first realization that the body had this ability to be able to heal itself. And it was also one of the reasons why I wanted to become a naturopathic doctor, because I wanted to be able to help people like myself so they didn't need to suffer unnecessarily like I had for so many years. Mm. So that was my reason to becoming a doctor. And then when I was in my second year in school, my dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I started doing a ton of research into treatments for cancer. And I was amazed by how much information was out there in order to effectively treat cancer. And I just started into that research, and I was amazed by how much information was out there. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to save my dad. He passed away 9 short months later. I just didn't have enough time. But that that definitely was the reason and the focus of why my practice is really focused on treating cancer today, because I just continued on that research and was just coming across a ton of information out there that was effective for treating cancer. I visited with and trained with a number of doctors who were having a lot of success in treating cancer, and that's how I came to just have a focused practice in terms of cancer.
It's a particularly aggressive form, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are no good cancers, but I know that a friend recently died from pancreatic cancer, and I know that it's a particularly aggressive one, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately it was. And so that's the challenge. Mm. But there's a lot of things that I've come to realize is that in terms of the testing, in terms of cancer, I'm going to say like about 6 months before he was even diagnosed, he did go in for an annual physical, got all the regular blood work done, and was told that, you know, he was the picture of health, right? Like, wow. Everything was mm-hmm. within normal range, you know, and that made me realize, you know, that there's other testing out there that you can be doing to make sure that the body is functioning well. And so those are some of the testing that I've incorporated into my practice so that we can pick up on things that are out of balance before they become pathology.
Yeah. You stand a fighting chance then, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. Helping people along that way.
Mm. And so presumably you mentioned that it was suggested to you to go to a naturopathic doctor. I assume that you'd been going to traditional doctors to try and treat the allergy issues and things that you had previously to that without much success.
Yeah. And I tried lots of different creams and remedies and stuff like that, but nothing that had long-term benefit. Like, it would just always return back. And so then we were just going through and trying to figure out, you know, which foods were causing my allergies, and we'd be taking out foods and introducing foods and just trying to pinpoint what exactly was causing my problems. You know, there were some foods that were definitely, you know, like, as soon as I ate them, I would break out in a rash. Things like strawberries was what I remembered, because I loved eating strawberries. And then I had to remove it from my diet because it would, every time I would eat it, I would just break out in a rash.
Mm, yeah, not much fun. Perhaps you could just, I mean, most people have a really general good idea of what the real difference is with a naturopathic doctor, but perhaps you could just elaborate a bit on that and tell us a bit more about the, you know, the nitty gritty difference, if you like.
The way I typically will describe it is that, first of all, like, in terms of like the conventional approach to medicine, a lot of it is really focused on just removing symptoms. Mm. Whereas as naturopathic doctors, we're trying to figure out why people have issues and try to address those underlying causes. So we're just digging a lot deeper into people's health issues and trying to figure out more of those underlying causes, those underlying imbalances, what's affecting a person, what's affecting how their system is functioning and working, and trying to get their systems to be able to function better. So those are really the focus, is that we're really trying to dig deeper, trying to find out what those underlying causes are in terms of what's showing up in terms of their health issues. And it's not just about making sure that their symptoms go away. It's making sure that we get a person who is more balanced and more healthy in the end. And in that, we get patients who have like long-term sustainable results, similar to like my eczema, that it wasn't that I just put a cream on and it went away when I had that cream on, that years later, I no longer suffer from eczema. That's, I'd say, the basic difference, is that we're not just tackling the symptoms, we're tackling the why.
Mm, absolutely. And what happens with the training? Is there a big difference in training right from the get-go, or is there a kind of starting overlap and then you diverge into the different paths? How does that side of it work?
Yeah, and I think that's an important question to ask. And I think that that's an important one for the public to really know, is that in North America, I don't know, I think it might be different in Europe, but in North America, we have to have an undergraduate degree, so a university degree. So I have a Bachelor of Science in Kinesiology. And then from there, you apply to the naturopathic medical schools. In Canada, there's only 2 accredited naturopathic colleges in all of Canada. And in all of North America, I believe there's 7 or 8. There's really not that many that are fully accredited. So you actually want to ask people which school they went to, and you'd be able to pinpoint if they went to a legitimate school. Mm-hmm. It's a 4-year full-time program. We write board exams and licensing exams in order to practice. And our schooling is actually like we do all the basic sciences like you would do in conventional medical school. And then where we differ is that we then learn our different naturopathic modalities. And I think another thing that happens is that you kind of get stuck into a reductionistic way of teaching. And that's how you have to teach in terms of different systems of the body. But we also learn how those different systems overlap and how they influence each other. And that's one of the big differences. And then we also learn all of our different like natural modalities. And so in terms of naturopathic medicine, it's really like an umbrella term for many different natural therapies. So we learn nutrition, and we learn botanicals, and we learn homeopathy, and we learn physical medicine. And so we learn a huge range of therapies. And then we kind of have a lot of tools in our toolkit in order to address patients' needs. So that's another big thing, is that we don't have a limited toolkit. We have a lot of different options in terms of treating patients.
Mm, really interesting. So I know also you have a keto story. So tell me a bit about when and why and how keto came into your life.
Yeah. So coming across keto has probably been about like a 16-year journey in that, first of all, in school, I learned about the problems of some of the major inflammatory foods. So the wheat, the cow's dairy, the sugar. So in my own personal life, I cut those foods out. And then when I was practicing, I was working with a functional medicine doctor, and we were just deciding, oh, let's run like a whole battery of tests on myself so we can just figure out what kind of shape my body's in. And one of the tests we decided to just add in was a celiac test. Mm. And we added in the celiac test, and I was super surprised when it came back, and it came back that I was positive for celiac disease. So from there, I cut out gluten out of my diet. So then I was on that journey of removing gluten. And then from there, I was reading about, the problems with grains in general, I guess more of that paleo movement. And so I sort of shifted into removing grains from my diet and having more of a paleo diet. Then I learned about things like intermittent fasting. And so I started incorporating intermittent fasting into my lifestyle and learning about the benefits of intermittent fasting and putting your body into autophagy. And so I started to incorporate that into my diet. So I was more of, you know, grain-free, intermittent fasting. And then I was learning about the ketogenic diet and the benefits of the ketogenic diet. And when I was learning about that ketogenic diet, I was a little bit more reluctant to dive into ketogenic diet. So I'd say that I was late to the party in terms of really getting into keto. But the more research I was coming across, I was saying, oh, like there's lots of great information about this. And one of the things that really got me interested in terms of that ketogenic diet was just understanding the benefits of that metabolic flexibility, in that we have like trained our bodies to basically use sugars as an energy source instead of us using ketones as an energy source. And I understood that in terms of that's what we're really trying to do in terms of that intermittent fasting. You're trying to shift the body so it's not using those sugars and it's using those ketones. And, you know, I was looking at my own lifestyle and I was like, okay, well, I eat paleo, which, you know, if you look at the diet, it looks quite similar to the ketogenic diet. And I do intermittent fasting. So I was thinking, oh, you know what, I'm probably get into ketosis. So then I started to test myself. And what I realized is that I wasn't in ketosis at all. And even when I was fast, I was not in ketosis. And I actually realized that it took me actually quite a while to get into ketosis, that my system did not shift easily, and that this wasn't an easy process in terms of me shifting into ketosis. It probably took me about a month of following the diet, continuously measuring my ketones. And I'm like thinking, does this keto meter actually work? Right? Because I just wasn't getting into it. And it took me about probably a month to actually even shift my metabolism into ketosis. And you realize, okay, well, that means that my metabolism actually isn't very healthy, that I'm not metabolically flexible. My body cannot easily shift from using that glucose as an energy source to using those ketones as an energy source. And I realized, you know, the benefits of our bodies being able to have that metabolic flexibility. And, you know, that's the way I describe health, is our body's ability to be adaptable. Mm-hmm. And if my body isn't able to be metabolically flexible, my body isn't able to be effectively at a healthier state, because I can't adapt to a world. You know, we talk about that world in terms of when we had hunters and gatherers, that they could adapt to episodes and times of being in feast and times when we had famine. And if our bodies are in a healthy stage, then we can have those feasts. And then in famine, then our bodies can adjust and use those ketones. Yeah. So my personal journey was realizing how challenging that is. And that's what I discuss with my patients. And when I get to talk on stages, I talk about this ability to be able to really, it's about like bio individuality, that it's different from person to person. Because, you know, just saying those percentages and how much you should be eating is going to be different from each person. And also with each person, as they become more keto adapted, then they can introduce more or higher amounts of carbohydrates into their diet. But, you know, at the beginning, I really had to like cut down on the amount of vegetables I was eating, which was surprising to me. Like I was thinking, I used to eat like a huge amount of vegetables, small amount of protein, maybe a little bit of extra fat in there. But I had to really cut down on the amount of vegetables I was eating in order to shift my body into ketosis. So that was like my journey into the ketogenic diet. And then as I did that personally, was working with my patients in terms of realizing the benefits of the ketogenic diet and cancer, and then helping my patients to use the ketogenic diet in terms of their cancer treatments, and realizing the challenges of it and helping people to be able to get into those levels. And then also learning about how you can use the blood sugars and the ketones in order to get into specific ratios, mm-hmm. to get them into better healing phases. So GKI index, right? So the glucose ketone index, and having people measure their blood sugars, measure their ketones, get into that proper ratio. Because what should happen is that as you get into ketosis, your ketones should increase and your blood sugars should decrease, and they should be in a better ratio. And the closer that ratios, we get into like a therapeutic ketosis, which is better for treating chronic disease and cancer. So yeah, that's been my journey into ketosis.
I'm really interested with what you were saying about how difficult you found it getting into ketosis in the first place, because I was expecting when you were saying, I mean, there's a big difference usually between someone coming from, say, a typical standard American diet and starting the ketogenic diet. You know, it's a big leap and it can take some time. Sure. And it still depends how, you know, insulin sensitive you are to start with, how quickly you adapt. But I would have expected somebody like you who was already eating paleo and probably, you know, not a million miles away from being ketogenic to really struggling that much for the first month. I mean, why do you think that is? Because it is certainly not what I would expect. I mean, were you still just very, very high carb paleo? I'm a bit bewildered by that. Or there were just still other things going on that still needed fixing.
Well, I think that I grew up sort of eating more of that standard American diet where, you know, you eat cereal for breakfast. I would have a sandwich for lunch with probably a pop and then a soda, and then have like a rice or a pasta or something like that for dinner. And I think that over time, eating that way just makes you more insulin resistant. So it's just that, yeah, like over time, I've just trained my body to not be allowing that glucose very well into my cells. So I think that for sure, my system is more just insulin resistant. And, and that was the challenge, in that even when you change it, and, you know, like I'd say that, you know, I wasn't really eating a lot of, processed foods, but some of the things that I would eat would be, you know, like one of the things that we would make as a family, like we would make these paleo chocolate chip cookies. And those paleo chocolate chip cookies, you know, they're super healthy. They're made with like almond flour and coconut flour and honey, right? So, but the thing is that they would still be considered like a high carbohydrate, right? So you'd still eat that. I would eat lots of vegetables. I would eat fruits, and all of those things would be what would continue to allow my body to still be in that more insulin resistant picture. And even so, I realized that as I try to measure those ratios of my blood sugars and my ketones, that being able to even get them into that proper ratio was super challenging too, to get my ketones up to that higher level, and to also try to bring my blood sugars down, that my blood sugars actually wouldn't come down really easily unless I was like fasting for periods of time. So yeah, I think that my system was just trained to be more insulin resistant, regardless of those changes I was making. Even though I was eating like a paleo diet, I wasn't eating grains, but I was still consuming a lot of not problematic, like I was say, like I would eat like a plate of vegetables, right? So they were still like really healthy and nutrient dense foods, but they weren't able to shift me very easily out of that insulin resistant picture. And I'd say that, you know, that for sure is still a challenge of mine, is that my system is still not easily shifted in terms of that insulin resistant picture. Because I was talking about that proper therapeutic ketogenic, which is that GKI, and you try to get those ketones down. And I know that for me, like I have to incorporate fasting, I have to do exogenous ketones in order to get into those therapeutic ketogenic ranges for my system. And I find that that's the same with a lot of my patients. So I know I'm not alone in that state, but I hear what you're saying, that, you know, like that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, oh, this should be easy.
No, absolutely. And I think that's something that's so important to remember. And and to remember that it matters a lot on the individual.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't judge easily what's going on the inside by what's on the outside by either their appearance or their diet.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a real contrast to you, so you were somebody who was insulin resistant and you were unknowingly continuing that insulin resistance just by not going down low enough, even though you were eating a pretty healthy paleo diet.
Yeah.
Whereas I've always been insulin sensitive. So even when I was basically twice the size I am now, so you could have looked at me and you might have said, oh, there goes an insulin resistant person, you know, whatever, eating dreadful diet, but I was still insulin sensitive.
Okay.
You looked at my blood test, my HbA1c would have been healthy. It was starting to get to the point where it might have started tipping over. My triglycerides would have been nice and low. So I was actually quite healthy on the inside, but there were all these problems. So I'm one of these really annoying people that when I really dial keto in and go really strict, I can, within a few days, I can probably have my blood ketones and my blood sugar at maybe the exact same number.
Which is amazing, right?
I'm lucky in that sense, but it just goes to show that, you know, appearances can be deceptive from all sorts of directions. And it's just, this is just something I think that's worth keep reminding people, for those people at home who are saying, well, how come that person finds it so easy and I'm really struggling and I'm doing all the things and I'm being stricter and I've been doing it for longer and I still find it more difficult? Well, that's kind of a bit of the sort of luck of the draw, unfortunately, that just sometimes that's why it's harder.
Yeah, for sure. And I see that too. And that's why I really want to emphasize that bio-individuality picture. Mm. Because I'll see people even just posting on Instagram, you know, they've just started the ketogenic diet and then they're showing their numbers and they already have high amounts of ketones. And that wasn't my experience. And so I don't expect that everyone is going to have that kind of experience. And yes, realizing that you have to really dial it in for a number of people.
Absolutely. And some people need to be stricter than others and stricter with things that they might not have thought they would have to be, like, you know, things like broccoli and stuff that you'd think would be fine to eat almost as much as you like. But for some people, it just isn't, at least to start with, as you mentioned before. When you get keto adapted, you've been keto for a while, you'll find you have more flexibility. And as you said as well, that's kind of what it's all about. So what to dive into first? There are all sorts of things you could be talking about. I think I'd quite like to jump in on, because you've already mentioned it, you've already discussed it a bit, and I'd certainly be fascinated to hear more about working in conjunction with people who have cancer and how you're finding keto works with that, maybe fasting as well. And I know people sometimes get very worried about it, and sometimes they're bumping up against traditional medicine where they're saying, you know, you shouldn't be using this approach and you certainly shouldn't be using it as an alternative. The way I see it as probably fitting is a really good adjunct in a really good way of just getting your body to be as healthy as possible. But I know it is sometimes said that it can be not a good approach to have. So I'd just like to hear all about that from your perspective and experience of working with people, obviously.
Yeah, and I definitely spend a lot of time trying to convince people that the ketogenic diet is going to be beneficial for them, because I think there is a lot of different information out there. And I think that the different information out there is just incomplete, right? So you need to get the full story. Because I think there's different ways that you can do the ketogenic diet. The one example is that you could be eating hot dogs and drinking diet pops, and that can get you into ketosis, but that doesn't necessarily make you healthier. So you need to be doing it in a really healthy fashion. That's one big part of it. You know, I think that a lot of people get nervous in terms of the ketogenic diet because a lot of people associate the ketogenic diet with weight loss. They think of it just a weight loss program. And, you know, some people who have cancer are having a challenge with losing weight. And so they're like, oh, I don't want to do the ketogenic diet because I don't want to lose any more weight. And it's not about weight loss. It's about changing up the metabolism in the body. And so they really need to understand that we're just trying to change the body's metabolism from being focused on terms of using glucose as an energy source to using those ketones as an energy source, and that it's not about making you lose weight. So that's one obstacle that we have to work on. And then the other thing that a lot of people will talk about is that they see a lot of things that say that eating a lot of animal protein is cancer causing.
Absolutely. And that's a big one.
And I think that that's something that's also like, it's kind of incomplete information in that you have to look at that source of animal proteins. So I think that like an animal that is basically an industrial raised animal that is raised on GMO grains, corn and soy, and injected with hormones and injected with antibiotics, that meat is inflammatory on a person. But if you look at an animal that's raised organic, grass-fed, grass-finished, the actual composition of those meats is very different. You can even just look at it from a fat component. You can see that the grass-fed, grass-finished meats they have a higher amount of omega-3s, that they have a high nutrient density to them, that they have a broader mineral profile because they're eating the foods that their bodies are designed to eat. The other thing is that you can also see when you're eating a diet that is the diet that their systems are actually designed to eat, they have the right gut flora. And when they have the right gut flora, then they absorb the nutrients and it makes those meats actually more nutrient dense. So you really need to be looking at having cleaner sources of proteins as opposed to those industrial meats. So I would say that's one of the inconsistencies, is that we have to understand that you need to be eating cleaner sources. You need to be eating cleaner sources of fat. And so some of those fats will be those animal proteins, but also having avocados and having coconut oil and looking at those different oils that you're having and making sure that you stay away from those industrial oils. So the canola oils and the soy oils and the sunflower oils and the safflower oils, all of those oils are industrial oils. And so in our bodies, they are inflammatory. So we need to make sure that we're having healthier fats, like avocado oils and coconut oils, and you're having the olive oils, the extra virgin olive oils. And then also, you know, like I will use like ghee for cooking now. And you could even use, if you're getting it from cleaner sources, you could even use like lard as
absolutely the hard fats,
right?
Yeah.
So it's just realizing the difference between the clean keto versus the dirty keto, right? But understanding that in order for us to get health in a body, that we need to be actually shifting the body to be into a cleaner sources. So those are part of like the education that we work on in terms of helping patients to understand that it's about changing that metabolism in the body, that it's making sure that it's cleaner sources of those foods. Those other cleaner sources is even when we're eating carbohydrates and vegetables, that you're having like organic vegetables. So those sort of things. So then you're removing a lot of that toxic load in the system. So we're shifting.
The only problem I have with that, and I don't have a problem with it in theory, I completely agree with it. But the problem I have on a practical level is that tends to go hand in hand with being more expensive. So what happens when you're on a budget and you simply cannot afford to eat those cleaner sources? they're just not really an option to you. That's the problem I have, because I feel like it adds this layer of, unfairness, I guess, that if you don't have enough money, you can't access, you're disadvantaging yourself by having these animal sources that have the different things attached to them you don't necessarily want to. I mean, my thoughts on it are that that's still better. That's going to be a significant improvement from eating the standard American diet. In comparison to that, it's fantastic. Yes, it could be improved by having cleaner sources, but you're still really, monumentally improving your diet by doing that. And I mean, I guess there's no way around it.
Yeah. I think that there's, and that's for sure a challenge, in our world, is access to it. The other one that if you had access to would be, like wild game. So people who hunt, and if you have access to that or getting that, sometimes that is more accessible. Mm. So game meat is also good because it's, again, it's animals eating what they're designed to eat. The other thing is that you don't have to be eating large amounts of these. You still can just eat small amounts and be able to sustain yourself. But it's just, I think that we also have to get over the fear of meat. I think that we have a lot of fear of meat. We have a lot of fear of fats in our society. And so it's getting over that fear. And then in terms of like organic vegetables and stuff, I think that what you can also do is you can also look at the lists of the foods that are highest in toxic loads and try to stay away from those high foods, or make sure you get those ones in organic foods. But yes, I know there's definitely a higher price point on those options, but I think that in the end, those are healthier. And I think that what we also need to do is we need to support the farmers who are actually making the effort to do those practices, and maybe even just getting in touch with those farmers and saying, okay, if I buy a quarter cow or half a cow, can I get a discount on it if I buy kind of a higher portion, or, can I do that over a year? So it's just trying to figure out how to make that sustainable. But I know it can be a challenge in terms of that price point, but I think that it's going to make a big difference in terms of our overall health.
Yeah, and think outside the box a bit and maybe look at different cuts as well. And especially like you just mentioned about potentially approaching farmers and producers directly. Often if you're prepared to take a mixed box that has things that aren't the ones that everybody wants, so, get a bit creative. A lot of people have been spending time at home. So, and I certainly have been growing more things myself this year.
Yeah.
I don't eat a huge amount of veg and stuff anyway, but I've been growing a few things. So I've had to buy hardly anything, been growing some greens, and I've been eating squash a lot lately because those. So I've got a lovely big harvest that's going to see me all the way through the winter. Fortunately, they taste like they're quite low carb. I keep meaning to taste them, but they're not overly sweet. So I'm very pleased about that. But yeah, I guess get a little bit creative and think outside the box a bit and try and find ways of actually getting these things a bit cheaper than is typical.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think that farmers and who are actually making the effort to try to supply these foods, they also want the consumers who are really dedicated to what they're doing and understand the reasons behind why they're doing what they're doing. In a lot of cases, they'd be happy to come up with a plan in order to make it accessible to the public.
Yeah, build some relationships. I think it's a good opportunity to do that.
Know your farmers, right? Mm. Yeah.
So you've talked a little bit about the approach, but how's this working on the ground with your cancer patients? How does that interact with the more standard treatment they're getting? How does it all work and fit together?
Yeah. So in my practice, I have kind of a range of people. I have some people who are doing conventional therapies, and then They're doing a lot of our therapies. So we offer a number of different therapies like high-dose vitamin C, IVs, and ozone therapy, and ultraviolet blood irradiation, and local hypothermias, and mistletoe injections, and diet changes, and supplements, and nutritionals, right? So we offer a lot of different therapies. So some people are doing the conventional therapies, and then they are using our therapies as supportive therapies while they go through like chemo or radiation or surgery. And then we also have some patients who are just doing naturopathic therapies and aren't doing any conventional therapies. And with those patients, we're definitely going more aggressively with our therapies. And really, you know, to me, diet is a huge component of their therapies. And really, I don't accept patients who aren't willing to do the diet changes, because I just find that we just don't get the results if they're just coming in for IVs and they're not willing to make those diet changes, which often surprises me that people aren't willing to give up their bread in order to really get them into a healthier state. But, you know, we do get a range of patients, but like I say that I'm lucky because I get to see patients who are really willing to be proactive about their health. So I get to see a very different segment of the population of patients who are really committed and proactive in their health. And when they're proactive in their health, we definitely see better results. So yeah, it makes it a lot more rewarding and makes it a lot more enjoyable to do what I do. But definitely there's challenges, right? Because you have to, I'd say that in terms of cancer, in a lot of cases, you don't have the luxury of time. Mm. So you have to actually be more aggressive with these therapies, and you have to make these changes with the diet. So you don't have that time to kind of think about it. You have to, you know, you just have to get in and do it. And I'd say that that's probably like some of the challenges, is like people kind of questioning, oh, is keto the right thing for me? And, you know, it's like, okay, no, we got to get doing this. We got to switch that metabolism as quickly as possible, as opposed to kind of easing people into it, which is like what most people would do. Most people would kind of lean into keto as opposed to aggressively start going into it. So yeah, those are, you know, some of the challenges of our approach of changing over that metabolism. Mm.
It's a difficult subject. It's something that I've thought about. What would I do if I got that diagnosis? Well, I'm already keto and I know the benefits of it. And I've certainly thought about it when the subject has come up for various reasons. And I think I would just get as, you know, as clean and strict as possible. But I'm really curious to know, what leads someone to make that decision about whether to go for conventional treatment alongside? Because I'll be honest, I've seen a lot of people take the alternative path only and completely shun the typical sort of chemotherapy, radiation, whatever the standard of care would be. I'm not sure. I would probably be too scared to shun the traditional approach as well. I think I would probably want to go for a combination, but I know people have done well going just purely down the alternative route, but it's something that makes me very, very nervous. So I'm interested what leads somebody to make one decision or another in, like you say, in that moment where you haven't got the luxury of time and this is a decision of your life, literally. And if you make the wrong one, what's going to happen? I don't know. I find the thought terrifying.
Yeah. And I think that's the challenge though, right? Is that when people get that diagnosis, they are put into a really like a fear state, right? And they're making decisions not out of knowledge. They're making decisions out of fear. I really think that people need to realize that they have options. And I think that a lot of people don't know that they have options. They think that their only option is chemo or radiation or surgery. And they don't even know about the world of alternative medicine. And they don't know that there's lots of different therapies out there that are quite effective. I tend to stack a lot of therapies on top of each other and do a lot. And people will say, well, which one's working? Is it the IVs that are working? Is it the ozone that's working? Is it the local hypothermia that's working? And to me, I think that they have a synergistic effect on each other and that they're all working together. And I really think that what we have to do is we need to educate patients. We need to educate patients on the different options that they have and what those options are actually doing within their body and understanding the effects that they're having on their system and how they're allowing that their bodies to be able to function better. And, you know, I run a number of different tests to figure out where are those imbalances in the body? What's wrong with that terrain? Which systems of the body aren't functioning optimally? And so that we can do a really targeted plan to that specific patient in order to get their systems functioning better. So to me, there is a level of education that needs to happen in order for us to have good results. And I would say that, like, even if you're doing chemo or radiation, you always need to be able to work on improving those organs of detoxification. We need to work on improving the immune system. We need to work on balancing out the gut flora. We have to work on changing up that metabolism in the body. So all of those things are important, whether you choose to go with the conventional route or whether you choose to go with the alternative route. You need to be working on these different aspects if we want to have, like, long-term sustainable results. And you don't want to have, okay, we got rid of the cancer here, but, you know, 5 years later, you show up with a different type of cancer, because you have to work on that process in the body that allowed those cancer cells to be able to grow in the first place. One of the things is that, you know, like, if with chemo and radiation, you are breaking down and killing cancer cells. But you have to make sure that those organs of detoxification, so the organs that move toxic loads out of the body, that they're open and flowing really well in order to make sure that that toxic load makes its way out of your body. Because that's one of the major challenges, is that whichever way you choose to go, if you don't have those organs of detoxification open and effectively moving that toxic load out, then you're actually making a person sicker. And that's my challenge in just watching people who only choose to do conventional therapy and don't do any sort of alternative or natural therapies, and not seeing that they need, regardless, they need some support to make sure that their system is functioning better. So, yeah, but I know it's a difficult decision, but I think that, yeah, part of it is education and watching, you know, or listening to podcasts like this and getting educated and understanding these things, because these are hard decisions that people have to make. And I think it's better to make a decision from an educated point of view as opposed to making a decision because you're just scared.
No, absolutely. I agree. The more informed a choice can be, the better. And it makes sense to me completely logically that whatever approach you're taking, that is, I guess, the part of the puzzle that is attacking and hopefully killing the cancer. That's just whatever approach you take, whether it's traditional or alternative. The point is that you need other things around it to make the most of that.
Yeah.
When it's going to happen. And that's something that's where I see something like eating ketogenically playing a really good role, or all these kind of things that are just giving your body the right system to really take advantage of whatever approach you decide to use and get the most out of it.
Yeah. And like, and when you really look at that ketogenic diet, when you look at cancer cells are thrive in this anaerobic metabolism. So it's where there's no oxygen there. And what they really thrive on and what really feeds those cancer cells in an anaerobic environment is glucose. So if you can remove that glucose and instead just supply the body with ketones, then you are actually changing the metabolism. And in a sense, you can call it like starving those cancer cells. Because if you don't have glucose in circulation, then those cells can't thrive. So that's where you're actually like changing the metabolism or that metabolic system within the body. And our healthy cells do thrive. If we remove that glucose, they can thrive on the ketones. So that's where it's really important to be able to shift that metabolism in the body from, and that's where the ketogenic plays such a big role because of that anaerobic metabolism of most of those cancer cells. And they are, you know, they're thriving on glucose. If you remove that glucose and only have ketones, they can't use that anaerobic metabolism of those cancer cells aren't able to use those ketones.
And ultimately, you can make that shift relatively quickly, as we've discussed before. It depends person to person how fast your body catches up. But even so, even if you're one of these people that takes a relatively long period of time, you can probably still make a massive change within a few weeks, a month, say.
Yeah, exactly, for sure. And yeah, and you're just making your system function better, right? And I think that that's what we want to see. And that's why I was really drawn to the ketogenic diet, was seeing that research in terms of it helping with cancer. And then making sure that I incorporate it into my own life so that I know how to help my patients to be able to get into ketosis.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, I heard you talking a bit about it on a podcast, and I was really intrigued because there are two things that impact me, but I know also that they impact a lot of other people, and that's the gallbladder. But something specific that you said towards the end was a link between bile flow and thyroid function. But I'm just really interested in particular when people run into problems with the gallbladder, keto often gets blamed for gallbladders going completely out of whack and gallstones and people having to have surgery or maybe have their gallbladder removed. Mine was actually removed electively before I had weight loss surgery. Perhaps if I knew what I know now, I might have decided against that. But the surgeon wanted to remove it. He said it's often a case of people have real problems with it and end up having to have them removed when they get really inflamed and problematic. So he was of the opinion of removing it electively. So I hardly noticed. And I was given no information about how to eat post gallbladder. So I just sort of carried on regardless. And luckily, I've never really had any problems. Although there's one thing that I suspect might be to do with lack of gallbladder. And so this is a question for you, and you might be able to answer my suspicions. So gallbladder came out, had weight loss surgery, had the awful band, which is awful, but went on to have sleeve, did very well from all that point of view. One of the things that cropped up that I became severely deficient in was vitamin A. And really, it just kept getting worse. It was tested and the doctor gave me really high dose vitamin A suspended in oil, which didn't work. I carried on getting deficient. He gave me higher and higher doses, carried on getting deficient. In the end, they were injecting it, carried on getting deficient. And it was only when a friend of mine told me I needed to take dry form, not suspended in oil, that I started doing that off my own back. They wouldn't provide it here. I bought some dry form tablets, started taking a fairly high dose, and I got my levels back up. And ever since, they've been fine. And I've always wondered, was it something to do with the weight loss surgery? Was it something to do with the gallbladder? I don't know.
So yeah, I would say that it's related to that gallbladder. The reason for that is that what your gallbladder's doing is it's holding on to something called bile. Mm. And then bile gets released anytime we are consuming fats. And that's a huge connection between the ketogenic diet and the gallbladder, is that in terms of the ketogenic diet, it's a high fat diet. And so we have to make sure that in most cases that that gallbladder is working really well. But how that relates to what's going on with you is that that gallbladder, what it's doing is releasing that bile to help us absorb fats, but it's also helping us to absorb fat-soluble vitamins. And our fat-soluble vitamins are vitamin A, D, E, and K. So the fact that you were actually getting deficient in A was likely because you didn't have that gallbladder, which is that gallbladder, what it is it's a time release of that bile. So it released that bile in response to you having a certain amount of fat in the diet. And it will help you to properly absorb the fats from your diet. And the other thing I always talk about is how important fats are in our diet. You know, like fats are part of every cell membrane in our body. It's what forms our brains, what forms all of our hormones in our body. And so we need those fats in order for our systems to be healthy. So we need fats, and then we also need those fat-soluble vitamins. But there's also another connection there too that I wonder about, is that there's also like a genetic SNP where we actually can't effectively move vegetable fats into the fats that our bodies need in terms of bioavailability. So we actually need those fats from animal proteins and animal proteins that will happen to be rich in that vitamin A, which is potentially what you were consuming with that dry source of vitamin A.
Right. Because I always wondered, it made complete sense to me that there was a problem with the breaking down the fat. That's why I started connecting it with the lack of the gallbladder and the whole, because it was dry form. I don't know exactly how the dry form is being made up, but there was something to do with when it's suspended in fat, I can't pull the A out. But when it's a dry form, for some reason, I can access that A, which was proved by the fact that my A got back up to a good level and has stayed there actually without further supplementation. So I just always been intrigued.
Yeah, I think that, with that dry source, I bet you that dry source was from like an animal source that was already bioavailable. Right. And so your body was able to easily absorb it. Mm-hmm. That's one of the challenges. You know, that's part of some of the advice that I give when people get their gallbladder out, is that they should be taking those fat-soluble vitamins. They really should be taking them on a consistent basis to make sure that they don't become deficient in them. D is really important in terms of our hormone balance, and K is important in terms of our bones, keeping strong bones. So, you know, realizing that we need those vitamins in order for us to be healthy.
And presumably you'd probably say, you know, hold on to your gallbladder as long as you possibly can. I mean, for me, it didn't seem to make a huge difference, but I know people get to that point where they have to make that decision about whether it comes out. You know, they're in intense pain and all these issues. I mean, the way I see keto is that it exacerbates a problem that's already there. It just brings it to the fore, because that problem with the gallbladder was already there and building. And once you start keto and you start pounding a load of fat through the system, it just raises its hands in horror and says, I can't deal with this. But it's not actually keto that's caused the problem. It's just brought it to the fore.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that that's what you actually have to realize, is that gallbladder has to be working quite well when you start that ketogenic diet, and you need to be supporting. And if you don't have a gallbladder that's working really well, you need to be able to support that gallbladder through especially those beginning stages of changing your diet, in a lot of cases from like that standard American diet to now a really high fat diet. Gallbladder, typically plays a big role, but I wouldn't say that ketogenic diet causes gallbladder problems. I would say that it's the other way around, that you had a pre-existing problem in terms of that gallbladder that was going on. You had a gallbladder that wasn't functioning optimally. And then with the ketogenic diet, it really just highlighted that issue.
And then presumably there is this tipping point where some people simply will have to have it removed.
Yeah, and there are cases that their systems like aren't able to handle it. But like in a lot of cases, it is a problem that can be solved without the removal of the gallbladder. And I think that that's something that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, we have ways to try to dissolve a lot of those calcifications. If you are showing a lot of gallstones, if you have some sludge, also there's ways to dissolve that. There's ways to help to support that gallbladder function without having to completely remove that gallbladder. So that's where consulting with a naturopathic doctor would be really beneficial for you.
So it sounds like it would be a good thing to get checked out. Is it relatively easy? But say you've got no suspicions, you've got anything wrong with your gallbladder, other than maybe, I guess, if you've been eating a pretty high carb standard American diet for most of your life, the chances are good that there might be some gallbladder issues, because that's the kind of thing that causes it, isn't it? So is it easy to find out? So to say, you know, I'm thinking of doing a ketogenic diet, I'd like to assess how well my gallbladder is functioning.
So I'm going to say that it's not necessarily super easy for us to evaluate the function of the gallbladder. It's not like it's a blood test that we send away for. Like I have different tools and systems in my office that I can assess that gallbladder, but I'd say in general, it's probably not an easy assessment. But I think that what you could do is like as you slowly start to increase that fat in the diet, then you can see, you know, are you getting more problems? We can even know it symptomatically wise in terms of your stools. As you increase the fats in your diet, are you having a lot more? What happens is that you end up with more floating stools. So it shows that you have more fats in your stools that aren't being properly metabolized. So sometimes we can just figure it out more symptomatically as people are increasing the amount of fats in their diet. And then the easy way to help that system along is to incorporate some of those digestive enzymes that help to break down some of those fats, incorporating some of those bile salts into the diet. And you can do that as you just start to increase fats. That just helps the body along, whether you have gallbladder issues or not. Yeah, so it's not an easy answer to that question, unfortunately.
So it's more of a symptomatic thinking about the symptoms. Are there any other really sort of typical symptoms? You mentioned stools there, but is there anything else generally to look out for? It sounds like it's just a good thing to be aware of. And then if it's something you suspected, you could support the system, like you say, with bile salts and digestive enzymes, which would presumably then alleviate the symptoms.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at least go part way to.
Yeah, and that would definitely help the process along. Well, I think just being aware of like what the gallbladder feels like when it's out of balance. And usually it's when you have that high fat diet, you get a bit of pain on that right side, kind of around the rib cage area. Mm-hmm. So that's where that gallbladder is. But people will actually get some pain there. They may get some nausea with that. And then that pain can sometimes wrap around the right side to the back. And so sometimes people will get a little bit of back pain in there and they're not sure. I just ate a high fat diet. I feel a little bit nauseous. I get a little bit of a stomach pain. And those are some beginning signs that that gallbladder's out of balance. So paying attention to that, because some people don't even know that that's what they're experiencing. Mm. And some people also like have been experiencing that for years and just think that that's normal. Yeah, that's absolutely just what happens when I eat. Mm. I just get a little bit of stomach pain.
Mm, definitely. And what's the link with hypothyroid? Because that fascinated me.
Yeah, so there is a link between, in terms of bile insufficiency, so a lack of proper bile flow, and hypothyroidism. And it seems like what we need is we need proper bile flow in order for our bodies to be able to properly convert the T4, so the inactive T4, into the active T3. So we need proper bile flow in order for that reaction in our body to be able to go through to completion, which means that That's how our thyroid actually gets turned on, is through proper bile flow. What they've shown in studies is they've shown that if we have a lack of proper bile flow, that we actually see an increase incidence of hypothyroidism. I think it's like a sevenfold increase in the research, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it's interesting research to see that how important that bile flow is in terms of hormonal balance.
Really interesting. And anyone who has anything to do with hypothyroidism knows what kind of impact that has on their metabolism.
Yeah.
So what happens, you know, if you don't have a gallbladder anymore, it's not like you don't produce bile anymore. You just can't store it. So it's more of a general trickle than a store and dump situation.
Yeah, exactly.
But is there anything that people who don't have gallbladders anymore, is there anything we can do to optimize that trickle?
That's important to understand. And I wish more doctors who remove gallbladders would also let their patients know that there would be changes. Like, luckily for you, you didn't notice anything significant, but there is a lot of changes that could potentially happen in terms of removing that gallbladder and having that basically that time released control in terms of that bile into the digestive tract, because what produces that bile is the liver. So you still have the liver, and the liver is now just slowly releasing that bile into the small intestines in order to break down and properly absorb those fats. Now, what I suggest people do when they have their gallbladder removed is to space out their fats. So not consume a large amount of fats in one sitting. So you're going to be distributing the amount of fats you're having throughout the day. So that can also help with that slow trickle. The other thing I suggest doing is taking those digestive enzymes that help to break down fats, like a lipase. And then you want to be taking bile salts, so you're helping the body to properly absorb the fats that you are taking in your diet. And then you want to do things that would help with better absorption of your fat-soluble vitamins. So you want to be supplementing with fat-soluble vitamins to make sure that your system isn't deficient in them in the end. And then, like, I usually do some supplements that actually help to support, even though you don't have the gallbladder, to help support that system. Yeah, so those are just some things that we could be doing and incorporating in to make sure that we support the body, even though it doesn't have a gallbladder.
I'm very for the idea that the body sort of finds its way to adapt.
Yeah.
To, you know, whatever changes you make. And I think maybe, you know, this is quite a long time ago that it happened to me, that I think maybe my body has learned to adapt. It probably would have quite liked a few more of those helping hands along the way. And I don't know for sure. There might still be things I can do. But so, for example, I do test fairly regularly for specifically other things as well, but for those fat soluble vitamin levels, because I'm very aware that they could be impacted. And I seem to have got to a place where I maintain them at good levels. So I think probably my body has adjusted, but yeah, maybe I need to think again. But like I say, it's been quite a long period of time. So I think maybe I forced it into doing it bit by bit the hard way, whereas I could have probably made its life a bit easier.
Yeah, but I do agree with you. I do think, like, our bodies are amazing at being able to adapt and change, especially to what we're doing. And I think that, you know, like, that's what we talk about in terms of being keto adapted, right? Mm-hmm. Is that as you become more keto adapted, then you can be more flexible. And that can likely of what's happened with your gallbladder is that your system is just adapted to those changes and is making those changes as needed. So I think your system's in good shape, right? And just keeping an eye on those fat soluble vitamins, you're not having major pain, keeping an eye on those stools. Yeah, then you get your system in good shape.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I find it very interesting. Well, there are all sorts of other things I could be asking you about. We're going to have to get you back another time if you'd be happy to come back.
I would love to.
You're an absolute treasure trove of information, but we're out of time for today. So maybe you could leave us with a top tip.
My top tip would be, this is really the focus for me, is always making sure that you take care of your gut health. I think that gut health is central to us having overall health in general. And I think that what we need to do is we need to make sure that we focus on improving our gut health. That's from the foods we eat, decreasing the toxic loads, making sure that we're supporting that microbiome, so that ecosystem of bacteria and fungus that live within our gut. And the better we can take care of our guts, the better health we're going to be in overall.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. Before we go, there'll be links and things in the show notes, but where can people find you, find out more about you?
So the best place to find me is my website, which is advancednaturopathic.com. That's where you can really find all the information about me. And in terms of social media, the place where I hang out the most is Instagram. And my handle there is Dr. Melina, M-E-L-I-N-A, Roberts. And I'm always posting health information. So I think that if you're interested in what I do, that's a great place to follow me. All right.
Wonderful. Will do. Thank you very much. It's been a very great pleasure, Melina. Thank you for sharing some of your time with me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun chatting.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from an unknown author. One day you'll look back and realize that you worried too much about things that didn't really matter. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.